Well, I want to just begin by welcoming all of you. It's so wonderful to celebrate this feast day with you. I know getting to Easter Sunday is no small task. I'm pretty sure I destroyed a Pez dispenser on my way here before I got out the door. I do not think that Pez dispenser will make it to the resurrection of the dead. But I'm grateful that y'all have all made it here, and if you are new here, I want to give you a special welcome. If you're new to town or just new to St. George's, I'm delighted to worship with you. Now, today is, as y'all know, this is the greatest feast day of the Christian calendar. It is superior to Christmas. It is superior to any other day of the year, and it has been really since the very beginning of the church's life. And it has been that way because the resurrection means so much for us. You see, it means things about our bodies. It means things about our relationships. It means things about our communities. It means things about all of our cultural goods. It means things about creation. It means things about what Jesus taught us. It means things about our work and our vocation and our churches. And probably as much as anything else, really, it means things about our death, about your death and my death, and about our future hope that we have in the life to come. Now, what's interesting, I think, about all of this day is if we truly want to believe in the power of the resurrection, we have to first see that there is no real proof that you'll find. There's no sort of excavation site in the Near East that you can go dig around in and prove that Jesus Christ actually rose from the grave. You see, the proof that you and I have, even on a day like today, is the faithfulness of God. That's the proof. In other words, I want to detail to you, to describe to you today, how the resurrection of Jesus shows us how every single promise that God has made to you and to me and to all of the people who have gone before us is absolutely true. That's all I want to talk with you about today. How the resurrection in Jesus' actual body is grounded in, how it expresses and how it reveals to us the faithfulness of the living God. And I want to walk us through this topic and really three primary movements. They are creation, covenant, and consummation. Creation, covenant, and consummation. So to begin, creation. Last night we celebrated what's called the Great Easter Vigil. It's one of the more ancient rituals of the Christian church. And one of the most striking things about that service, maybe some of you were there, it's not just the beauty or the music or the ancient language, it's sheer length. It's like a really, really long service. Some of you are there. You can remember. We stayed up till like 10. As by the way, if you have kids in that service, I applaud you. That is truly incredible. That's a miracle, an Easter miracle in and of itself. But it's length. And the reason it's so long is because it goes through all of these biblical texts. It goes all the way back to Genesis, because the architects of this service, you see, they knew that if you want to talk about Jesus' resurrection and really describe what it means for us, you actually have to go back to the very beginning. You've got to talk about creation. And so the very first reading of that service, it draws from Genesis 1 and 2, and it details how all of the world was made. And there's one word at the beginning of Genesis chapter 2 that I think describes the whole scene perfectly. It's the word rest. You see, in Genesis 1 and 2, it goes through and describes how God made all of the world that you and I live in 6 days. But then it says that on the seventh day, God rested. He rested. What could that mean? Well, of course, this doesn't mean that God was tired. It doesn't mean that he'd spent all of his creative capacities. Psalm 121, it reminds us that God does not slumber, he does not sleep, he doesn't grow weary. So the tradition is typically noted. What this means is that in one culminating moment in the whole creation saga, God simply stopped. He just stopped. Why? Why would God stop? simply so that he could abide. He could behold the goodness of everything that he had made. He simply wanted to bask in the glory of the created order. Now, some of you may know this. I have a one-year-old daughter, maybe somewhere in this building. She's 18 months old, and it's my job every night to put her to bed. And when I put her to bed and I begin to rock her to sleep in my arms, she eventually falls to sleep, usually on my chest. And there's this moment in the evening where I simply stop and I listen to her breathe. It's one of the best moments of my whole day. And in that moment, I'm filled with this deep, deep sense of gratitude. But also in that moment, there's one thought that goes through my head, and it's this: I will never, ever stop wanting to be her father. I'll never, ever not be her dad. And so you see, when God rests on the seventh day, it's just like that. He holds as if he could. He holds creation all in his arms. He gathers it to his chest, and he says, I will never, ever stop being your God, no matter what. That's what God resting on the seventh day means and is. And so we see in this opening scene, God rests with his creation, and what it means is that God affirms all of his creation so much that he cannot ever, ever, ever let it go. He could never hate what he has made. And in this way, I want you to see that God's resting of with creation is gathering up into his arms his awe at what he has made. It's actually a kind of promise. It's a promise. And in it, he says, come what may, no matter what, I will not forsake what I have made. And I want us to see that this has everything to do with the resurrection of Jesus Christ. That's movement one, creation. But now, all of you know this, the second movement, there is a come what may moment in the Genesis story. It's just in Genesis chapter 3. It's at the very beginning. Human beings turn from God. Rather than depend on them, they seek to be their own gods. And while we could describe all of this in sort of discrete, specific theological language, we all know this condition very, very well. It is deeply familiar to us. It is a condition, as you know, where people die. It's a condition where people have addictions. It's a condition where people hate themselves and hate one another. It's a condition where we cling to our things with a death grip. It's a condition where we cover up our bodies in shame. And it's a condition, as we found out in the past couple of weeks, of unspeakable pain. What I want you to see here is that this is absolutely critical. In this condition that you and I live in, even today, God did not have to do anything. You see, in the promise that God makes with creation, he tells us that he delights over what he has made. He tells us that he will not ever stop being our God. But that does not mean that he couldn't simply step back and watch from a distance, which we have to admit is a horrible thought. But just a few chapters after we see the beginning of this condition, as soon as we move out of chapter 3 of Genesis, we see that something else begins to happen, something very strange. God begins to make specific promises to specific people about specific things. He begins to make promises to people like Noah and Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Moses and David and Solomon and Isaiah and Ezekiel, all of these people that we have heard about that you can read about in your Bible. And I want you to just listen to some of the promises that he makes to these people. Genesis 9:11, I will never again destroy the earth. Genesis 12:2-3, I will make you into a great nation. All the peoples of the earth will know you and be blessed by you. Exodus 19:5-6, you will be my treasured possession. I will make you into a kingdom of priests, a holy nation. 2 Samuel 7:15-16, my love will never, ever be taken away from you. Isaiah 59:21, I will pour out my spirit upon you, and the words that I have put in your mouth will ever be on your lips, upon your children and your children's children forever and ever. So don't you see how amazing this is? The darker things get, the more wayward God's people become, the closer he gets, the closer God gets. He promises to bless and to build and to abide and to encourage and to treasure. And in all of these promises, you see there is almost a sense of God binding himself closer and closer to our very life. There's a sense in which he is sealing our fate with his own. So that's the content of these promises. Now, before we go on, I simply want you to know also the form of these promises. The specific term for these promises, if you read in the Old Testament, is a word covenant. It's a common biblical term, and it simply means a promise established, one, formally between legal, military, or familial parties, and then two, it is a promise that is established in blood. It's established in blood. And in fact, the word covenant, it literally means to cut. And so the covenant that God makes with all of his people, you see, they are, in fact, covenants made unto death. They are military-grade promises that are made unto death. And so the content, again, of these promises is blessing, growth, presence, healing, all of these good things. And then the form, you see, is as strong as a promise could ever get. And it kind of reminds me of a famous story. Maybe you know it. It's about the Spanish explorer Hernan Cortez. Again, you've probably heard it in one of Cortez's journeys to Mexico in the early 1500s. He sailed from Cuba to Mexico. When he arrived on the coast with his 600 men, things began to get hard. But as soon as things got hard and his troops began to lose their morale and resolve, he got into his boat and he sailed into the harbor. And he sunk all of his own ships into the ocean. So you see, their fates were bound to one another. And in a way, you see, that's exactly what God's promises do to us. He binds his fate with ours permanently through the integrity of his own covenant. So that's movement two, covenant. And it also has everything to do with the resurrection of Jesus. But now we also have to see, just because God has made this covenant, just because God has bound himself to us, that does not necessarily mean that things must go well for his people or for you. Think about it. Cortez can sink his ships, he can bind his fate with his crew, but the well-being of his crew is still dependent on the resolve and the fortitude of their captain. And so I think that this begs the question, are the promises given to us in the covenant made by God, are they actually good for us? Do we even want these promises in the first place? You have to see that on Easter Sunday, the answer is an unqualified and definitive yes. That's what Easter is about, a yes. Why? Because as we noted in the Matthew passage, the actual body of Jesus comes out of his grave, and you'll note he is not something superhuman, he is not something grotesque, but he is the same man with the exact same body, living and breathing a body just like yours and mine. And that is profoundly good news because it proves without a shadow of a doubt God's goodwill toward you and toward me. It's like this. There was a famous sermon given way back in 1631 by a priest and poet, famous Christian thinker named John Donne. It was actually his final sermon. He gave it at St. Paul's Cathedral. It was about a month before he died. And in it, he asks a very simple question. He says, how could it be possible that the dead corpse of Jesus did not rot in the grave? Strange question. He goes on, he asks, what was it? Was it the embalming spices? Could that have done it? He says, no, those wouldn't last. Those wouldn't do it. Then he says, was it Jesus' sinlessness, his innocence that preserved him in the tomb? He says, no, if you're a good Christian, you know that Jesus takes on our sinful nature. Then he says, well, what if it was the union that Jesus shares with God the Father? And he concludes, no, it couldn't have been that either, because that would separate Jesus' body from his soul and would make him something less than human. We are, in fact, unified people. He then says, what was it? And his answer is very simple. All he does is he simply quotes Psalm 16, verse 10. He says, he will not suffer thy Holy One to see corruption. And then he concludes, quote, his body was preserved by the will and pleasure of God. His body was preserved by the will and the pleasure of God. And you see what this means. Jesus comes out of the grave with his same body and thereby validates all of the good promises given to us to bring us life and blessing and peace and hope and flourishing and goodness. Because it is his body. And it also means, of course, that none of his good decrees can ever be broken. I want you to simply pause and think about that for a minute. Think about the way all of the promises are answered. Remember, God promises to preserve what he has made at the very beginning, and the body of his son who was dead on a cross comes out of a grave. God promises to give Israel holiness, and the perfect Israelite greets his disciples with shalom and peace. God promises blessing over his people, and the one who heals the sick and the dead walks out of the grave still carrying his wounds. And it's even more than that. God promises to build his people into a kingdom, and all of Jesus' friends who scatter at his death suddenly return and gather around his presence after the resurrection and then expand across the globe. So don't you see, the resurrection, friends, it is the consummation. It is the consummation of all of God's promises. And in a way, if you know God, if you trust him, if you are familiar with him, if you are intimate with him, the resurrection of Jesus Christ is the most likely thing in the world. Because you know God's goodness. You know his steadfastness. And so that's movement three, consummation. But finally, I do want to note simply on this Easter Sunday that this is a special Sunday for this city. It is it's not lost on me that even now, brothers and sisters at Covenant Presbyterian Church are gathering for worship just down the road. Of course, these are people that you know. These are many of our friends. Some of them are family members. Some of them are your neighbors. And on one level, deep in your gut, if you are honest, you might think, why in the world would people gather at a place like that to worship God? Why would you do that? Why now? But don't you see, friends? These very regular people that we know, that I know, just like you and me, are gathering together to worship God because they believe profoundly and completely in the promises of God made evident in the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. You must realize they literally named their church after the promises of God made to us in Jesus Christ. And so simply on this Easter, my hope for all of you and for all of us is simply that together with them, we might renew our steadfastness and our hope and the love and the surety of God's faithfulness over us. My hope for you this Easter season is that by looking at the steadfast promises of God, you might come to trust him more and more and glory in the resurrection of his Son. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, amen.